we get the return.
Some of them.
But you only, it's only up to the ones who
are sold.
Maximum amount to invest.
They can pay invest, if they invest 20 million, they pay one.
Yep.
And then they lose it all on day two. Then you have to wait till 2019 to get there. You just get there 200 million. You don't get 673 million.
Right.
So
you have to make that return.
But if they invested the whole 200 and lost the 200, under no circumstance do they ever give you more than 200
million.
No,
it's that's the way we read that. Okay. That's the principle. So we got to have a return. Otherwise, why have all of this stuff?
Right.
Have a return.
Right. But I'm not sure.
Okay.
I read the state's exposure is 200 million, now 600 million, whatever.
Yeah, that's the way we do it. Because otherwise, why bother?
Right.
I mean, and the reality is we want to get rid of this.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Yeah,
I'm
wondering about the
procedure. Sure. Yep. Definitely.
Okay, I wasn't sure
what
these processes
are. Okay.
Howard?
And I noticed the sign.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. Are you incorporating
anything? You know what? I should check what you guys have.
They don't have anything.
Oh,
there's no amendments to this bill.
Okay.
But I have that draft of this amendment if you want. I haven't had time to go.
All decisions. Okay. So that's right.
The Senate said that when they do this, the agency heads have to follow all the laws that apply to the commissioners in this chapter.
Right. As they should. I think that's appropriate.
Okay.
Let me show you the amendment that I have.
Okay.
I was going to essentially delete my money. I was going to delete that.
Sure.
Yes. And replace it with that. Right. Maybe you can take it.
Yep.
So you're deleting section one of the bill totally.
Yeah,
essentially.
Then the whole bill would just be
indeterminate.
Right. Sure. Yeah,
okay.
That makes
Does that do
sense.
What?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I, okay.
Definitely.
I just want to make sure that's doing what I intended to do.
I think this
was just, adding this in there.
Right. That's just a cross reference.
Right. So I'm just deleting. When I say I'm deleting section one, I'm not deleting this. I'm just deleting the changes.
Right.
Is that correct?
Right.
Okay.
You're just.
to make sure.
You're not repealing the existing.
Excellent.
Law. You're
that's what I wanted to know.
So, yeah. As
I imagine what kind of a thing I'd be opening up by doing that. So.
Right. No,
and
I think
that section.
And the commissioner, the administration folks have looked at this. So they
well, they're not in support.
Okay.
So. And I recognize that.
Okay.
But I just want to make sure that the 16C is the thing that sets in place the requirements. Is that?
Let me just double
okay.
check.
Okay. That just got dropped on my desk. So.
Sure.
Has it been on that? I'm sure.
Well, I think it has amended.
Well,
it doesn't look like it. When consistent with 16C6 subdivision 4, which is allowing the award a contract from the vendor, it's in the best interest of the state. So this is just saying when it's in the best interest of when the commissioner determines, I see when the commissioner shall expand the choice. No, I think it works.
This doesn't mess with the Senate.
No, this picks up the entire concept of what the Senate is doing because you have to comply
with
everything in this chapter.
That's what I wanted to make
all the small, all the all of those, and the Human Rights Act.
The big deal is that we're saying that they shall,
right,
as opposed to
right,
possibly.
Right.
So we're just finding out their commitment to be using
sure.
Okay.
And it does all those lots to do all that. It's like, you know, this is what that happens is. It's everything the commissioner would have to do.
You know what, I'm going to run out of copies.
So,
great, thanks a lot.
You can probably just focus. I wrote this.
Oh, you did? Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yep.
I
love
that. Thank you.
We're dining in.
Excellent.
Perfect. Did you number one?
I'm number two.
Okay. Okay. I understand you are really pretty wild.
Last
night
was
interesting. The initial investment.
I don't know that I was wild.
I heard interesting story.
It's the way it is now.
I was like, there is an
initial
investment. This one would just say.
Right. Right.
Provide a for the initial investment in the selected
right.
And we're limited to 200 couple places here. And
right.
Already,
no, so it's clear the initial can't yeah. be, but it, I mean, in the very first case,
yes.
you
we don't want to play that.
You
play
did it all in Techmar. Lost a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pardon me? Right.
Larry? Are you ready? You're all dressed up today.
Anything goes.
There you go. If there is,
then you have a sphere of 250 million. 2/3.
What a
cool
boss.
This looks a lot better than mine.
Is this just a in an arm glove?
The craft voice?
Right.
The non-elected
inquiry.
How can you dress up? You normally walk around in a much more casual.
Well, I wear jeans on Monday.
Well, on purpose. Okay.
Right.
By the way, your kinfolk, I guess, are traveling all around right now, and Jessica's was out in San Francisco for about 2 or 3 weeks, and Amy, my daughter, went out and spent a week with her. They had a pretty wild time. They're good kids, though. She's a wonderful young lady.
Let's see.
So we got
the
50% limit, 720%.
I feel weird now.
We're dining in today, Jim.
I see that. I saw the chair is eating. I can eat.
Well, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Teeson, it would be 6.
That last one
is 7.
I think you're better.
I thought I did okay.
Excuse me, Carl.
Right.
I have a roll call. At least you guys don't like it.
Here?
Well, now
yeah.
I've already
watered down.
Compared
to having
them
come up in
first.
Okay.
Okay. Is your bill very large?
What?
Is your bill very large?
What? Oh, yeah.
Is it? Ours is a tax increase. It increases taxes?
Well, it restores everything we cut last year.
It restores? Why do we get the money?
Why? Why do we
free money.
Well, listen, if it's
we're going to do this
I'll listen and find out if it's not the rules anyway.
Hi, Rory. One crisis after another.
We have a quorum, so we'll start. Good afternoon, and welcome to lunchtime with Government Operations and Veterans Affairs Committee. And we have. We have three bills up, I think, right? Okay. Representative House, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I did not, unfortunately, I forgot to ask any member of your committee to move the bill, so if you would be so kind. And it needs to go to rules.
Representative Jacobson moves Representative House 2653 to Rules Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will try to be very brief. In 2001, we passed legislation that would allow the Propane Council to be formed. They have been formed since that time. What they've done is they've trained over 2,200 industry employees in the safe use of propane. They've created different brochures like this one here for safety in ice fishing houses. They have one here for safety at construction sites and handling propane. And they also, Mr. Chairman and members, have a consumer guide. They've been very proactive in the propane industry in creating educational aspects of it for safety. The State Fire Marshal's office does support this. Unfortunately, they're not here today. And I believe the Minnesota Fire Chiefs also support it. And I have with me today Roger Leiter, who is with the Minnesota Propane Council, and will explain to you why they would like the sunset removed.
Okay. Welcome to our committee, sir.
Mr. Chairman.
Why do you want the sunset removed?
Mr. Chairman, the reason we want the sunset removed is that all these programs that we put out do help the safety of the consumers of propane within the state of Minnesota. With over 1.2 million of us already using propane for grill cylinders to various other reasons, it's pretty important to have that safety information out there. Any one of the marketing companies that are out there are unable to go out and develop, implement the extensive safety programs that we've developed so far. Together we can put that together and make it happen as a group. By eliminating the sunset, we're able to build a continuity of programs so that we can make commitments to these people, our consumers, as well as industry organizations and regulatory people. We also provide safety training to fire departments throughout the state, and we want to be able to continue that type of activity. We believe that this is the best way to do that. Also, even though we would eliminate the sunset, there are provisions within the law that will allow for the recall by the members or the industry itself if they feel that the money is not being handled properly. And that's done simply by a one-third vote of all those people. They can call for a vote, which would be a 50% vote would eliminate it. Or else our overseer of our funds, which is the Fire Marshal's office, can also call for that vote to have it. Or else this body, of course, could eliminate it at any time.
Is there any questions of the witness? Any Representative Erickson?
Well, Chair Rhodes, I just want to brag a little bit because Roger Leiter is my former student.
Now we're going to watch
good
your
thing.
English.
Oh, we got a problem.
We want a handwriting sample, and we're going to check your grammar, so be careful. Was she a good teacher, by the way?
Excellent teacher.
Representative Kahn.
Could that help?
Mr. Chairman, I understand, did someone say when the sunset date is?
Sunset date is August 1, 2009.
You know, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
We put these sunset dates in for a reason, to kind of have the agency have a little track record and to look at it again. And it just, and when did we pass this bill originally? You said that?
Representative House?
2001.
It just seems to me that we don't have to rush this fast to repeal the sunset date. Couldn't we wait, like maybe till halfway, 2005, 2006? How about
Mr. Powell? Chairman, Representative Kahn, I mean, you do raise a valid point, but as Mr. Leiter said, the industry has programs working now that do work. They want to start a new program. A lot of these programs continue on into the long future, and it's difficult to start a new one or to get people enthused about it if they know hanging over their head is a sunset date. The State Fire Marshal still has full authority to call this back in and say, we want to look at this, and we don't like it, we want to eliminate it. So we're not taking power away from anybody, but we're giving them the freedom to know that they can do this.
Well, Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, we put a sunset date on it. Why did we put a sunset date on it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, we put two on. We put one, was, I believe, July 1st, 2004, that if the council was not created, the legislation would just go away. Then we put one on for 2009, I thought it was 2008, but 2009, that, and I don't, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure why we put the 2009 date on there other than what you say is a good policy, some people believe, but I believe the fact that we have the State Fire Marshal and this body at any time can say, look, we want to take another look at this.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not a great fan of sunsets, and I certainly didn't pay an enormous amount of attention to this. But it seems to me we put it on for a reason, and to repeal it 5 years in advance when it's been on for 3 years doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. I haven't heard, I do on, you know, if it was like next year or something, but how long are the programs? You know, you develop programs, and I think that there are probably new programs, you know, new programs might come out, so I'm not so sure that that developing programs that are supposed to last past 2009 is a really good idea.
Many of the programs that we do, with all the changing technology and the things that change within the industry, there are changing safety needs, and so there will be programs that will change. The training of such people as fire departments and our industry personnel, we have about a 20 to 25% turnover in personnel in the industry every year. This means that there has to be continuity of programs. We have to have something out there for them. And we just feel that in order to set something in place that we feel can last a long time, we feel that this would be the important way to do it, to say we can make those commitments knowing that the rug is not going to be pulled out from underneath anybody's program later on.
Well, Mr. Chairman, legislature only acts on a two-year standard. You know, nothing we do holds for longer than 2 years. So I don't understand why we need to jump the gun to repeal this at this time.
I guess from the standpoint of the Minnesota Propane Association and the industry, we felt it's in the best interest to keep for the continuity of the programs for the future. That's really our stand on that and where we believe we should be headed.
Representative Boudreau.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to clarify, is there any opponents to this bill, Representative House?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boudreau, no.
Okay.
Representative Seifert, this is in your bailiwick of expertise on extensions of these sunsets and non-extensions.
Well, Mr. Chair, I remember this bill. I was just telling Representative Lesh about this. This is the committee that voted the bill down, I believe it was in 99 or 2000. Representative Osmond was the chief author, I believe.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert, Representative Osmond did take it to the floor and lost on the floor. I took it in 2001. This committee voted it down, and the next day they brought it back and voted it up. There was some confusion. Representative Kahn had some issues with the length of the bill and how it was structured. We restructured the bill and made it much simpler and more clear.
Right.
And then it did pass out of here quite handily.
Okay. Mr. Chair, what I was getting at was I believe Representative Osmond had the bill. It's probably in 99, and I think this was the committee that voted it down. He came back in 2000, got it out of here, went to the floor where it was voted down. Then you took over the authorship of the bill, and because it gave a new assessment, which some people would call a fee or a tax or whatever you want to call it, there was concern that there might not be oversight and that the legislature would just forget about the whole program, etc., because there was a little bit of controversy with it. So I supported the bill under the contingency that we'd have a sunset at some point in time. And I think we picked, I don't know, whatever it was, 09 or 07 or something. And so I happily voted for the bill and sent it on its way, and I thought that was the compromise that everyone agreed to. But, you know, whatever the committee decides is fine. That's the history behind it. This was the group that held it up in 99, and then in 2000 it came back, and 2001 it came back. And, you know, I thought the idea was that there would be a sunset at some point just so the legislature would take a look at it, because a lot of these special revenue accounts, as Representative Knobloch knows, are set up and we forget about them. So now we have, like, I don't know, what is 900 of them or something floating around. And that was the idea behind it. So I'm not losing sleep over this bill by any means, but that's just the history behind it.
Representative Howard, you had a question?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert, you mentioned special assessment accounts. The state government does not collect this money. This is money that the industry within themselves take from themselves, one-tenth of a penny per gallon, and they collect it, and they use it for educational purposes. This is not a tax. It's not added on. It hasn't been added on at all since the industry started doing this. And it's not a fee either. They self-assess themselves, so they have some money to work together as a unit to do this and provide this education. And the state fire marshal looks at their books every year to make sure they're doing it properly.
Well, Mr. Chair, to that point, I mean, I don't believe that anyone, there is no free lunch. I think the consumers of propane pay for the bill, whether it's added on as a extra item on their bill, probably not. But to say that someone's not, that this is a free lunch and no one's paying for this propane assessment, I don't believe it's being eaten. I think the people who consume propane in the state are the people who are paying for it. So, you know, I'm not saying it's a tax or a fee, but it's, you know, whatever you want to call it, someone is paying for this, and that was the whole idea behind it. So, like I said, I'm not arguing about the merits or lack thereof of this. I remember the discussion. I have probably one of the largest consumers of propane in the state, which is Schwann's. All those little yellow trucks you see on the road burn propane. They don't burn diesel. They don't burn gasoline. They burn propane. And the concern I had was if I have one of the largest consumers of propane, they have more vehicles on the road in the United States of America than any entity other than the U.S. Postal Service. I don't think people realize how big that company really is. It's a multi-billion dollar company. And a tenth of a penny doesn't seem like a lot, but when you're a multi-billion dollar company and you're the largest user of propane probably in the state, that adds up after a while. So they have not raised a lot of concerns about this to me. I've just used this in my head. I talked to Representative Osmond about it. He called the government relations director at Schwann's, and they seemed comfortable with the bill as it passed a couple years ago, so I supported it. So that's just the whole history of this. I'll just keep my mouth shut now.
All right, Representative Kahn.
Well,
is it the same thing or not?
Well, I do have a question about going back. You know, always nice to have one of these bright young minds who remember exactly everything that happened, so I will have some questions about that. But I'm not on the Regulated Industries Committee. Is there anyone on this committee who's on the Regulated Industries Committee who heard the bill?
Seeing none.
Then I guess I'll have to ask the author. Well, was there discussion? Did people look at the budget of this? Did they look at how the money is being spent? Did they look at any? What did the Regulated Committee, Industries Committee, look at when they decided to remove the sunset? Did they look at what the expenditures were and that sort of thing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I wasn't in the committee probably more than 4 or 5 minutes. They asked very simple questions. They did not ask how much money was collected. They asked, one thing they asked is how many people in the propane industry supported this when it really originally started, and the vote was 90% of the industry. We gave them that information. We explained what the bill, what the propane industry does, and that was pretty much it.
Mr. Chairman, can somebody tell me how much has been collected?
On an average, in the state of Minnesota, we've only been collecting since June of 2002, so we have less than a two-year history. But the state of, or the Propane Council collects about $500,000 a year.
$500,000.
Okay. And as to kind of go back to the question of add-on or fee, whether individual companies have to develop their own safety materials or their own educational materials and put them out, or whether we do it as a group and can do it more efficiently and less expensive, we feel it is much better to be doing it as a group than to have every individual company try to create materials that will not have consistency for the industry or for the consumer. So for that end, we feel that this is a pretty important bill to have here, and we believe that, again, the continuity is pretty important, that we have something that we can maintain.
Yeah. Anybody in the audience want to speak for or against the bill? Okay, Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, let me go back a little bit to the history of the bill, because now I remember the urging a simplified form, which seemed to be all that was needed. What happened to the bill when it came back from conference committee? Was it closer to the way it was introduced, or was it closer to the way it was amended to?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I do not recall that we had a conference committee.
Oh.
I believe that the language we came out with in the House was then the language used by Senator Murphy in the Senate.
Okay. Well, I'll renew my motion that House File 2653 be recommended to pass and go to the Rules Committee.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kahn.
I just want to point out, and I'm I'm voting no, will probably be the only no vote on this. So I just want to point, $500,000, which is collected from consumers, is not an insignificant amount of money. I say that the only reason we're looking at this now is because there's on a sunset. This is outside of our budget process. This is the only reason this is before us is because the sunset date is here, and I think that that's why we put the sunset date on it, so it would be looked at again. Now, I don't seem to get from the conversation much confidence that the regulated industries committee looked at this very seriously. And so, you know, your vote to say that this is all okay is a vote to say $500,000 isn't a lot of money and we shouldn't have to worry about the public concern. And
I don't think that's the case, but I remember it was you and Representative Krinke, I think, that teamed up the last time when we had a problem with the bill and was defeated. I think that was, I remember vaguely that. Representative Solberg?
I'm just saying
the only way we will, my prediction is, the only way we will ever look at the, we will never look at this again. Because the sunset, you know, the only reason we're supposed to look at it again was because of the sunset. I don't know if this is enough time to see how it acted without the sunset, but I'm not convinced that anything was, that it was looked at. If someone had said, yes, we had a hearing in regulated industries, that we looked at the, you know, we looked at what the money was being looked for, we looked at the programs, we talked to consumers, not just the industry, then I just feel a lot more comfortable that we could repeal the sunset, particularly because I don't see there's any great urgency to do this. We have until 2009, of which many, hopefully I won't be around to deal with it then, but the rest of you will be here and you can look at it.
Representative Solberg, to that point of being here in 2009?
Well, you know, maybe not even tomorrow. But the question is, I think, is a valid one on the use of money by groups that are, the consumer pays it. It's a fee, no matter how you look at it. It's one way or another. And sometimes when you add a tenth, they increase it a penny, so that you should never increase cigarette tax 3 cents. You should always go a nickel. Because the other people get it. But a serious question, I think, is a report to the legislature on the expenditures. And is the current law require that?
Representative Howes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, the state fire marshal, the propane industry has to bring their books to the state fire marshal every year. State fire marshal looks at it.
But does the state fire marshal then come before the legislature with that? Maybe
constantly. Would if we asked them to, though.
I understand they would. No, maybe council can clarify
Mr.
that.
Mr. Shepherd?
Mr. Chair and members, there is a requirement for an annual report on this program to the Commissioner of Public Safety.
But there's a, Mr. Chairman, there's no report to the legislature on the expenditures. Is that correct?
Yep.
That would be correct.
And I just asked the author how they would feel about that.
Representative Howes.
Mr. Chairman.
Report back to this committee or the...
Well,
or who?
Regulated Industries regulated Committee. Industries. I would think that it is a fee. You know, you always want to have at least, I think, some accountability to those that are elected officials.
Representative Howes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, I'm very comfortable with this program. We view it differently, I guess. I don't look at it as a taxpayer dollar that government is overseeing or that we as a body are budgeting and using. I'm very comfortable that the propane industry has to report to the Commissioner of Public Safety every year. If the Commissioner of Public Safety sees something that's not correct, I mean, he's under our purview, he would come to us. I guess, Representative Solberg, I'm very comfortable with this bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'm probably very comfortable with the program. I think I supported it. But I think Representative Knobloch and I have had some experience on funds that are just out there and are used probably for very good purposes and are used properly. But it's also good to have review of them.
Representative Solberg and committee,
Well, as we look at this throughout the propane industry, the marketers, each and every one of them, there's 195 to 205 different propane marketers in the state of Minnesota, all independent business people. At that rate, as you mentioned, possibly it's only a tenth of a cent, but they may add on a penny or they may add on a nickel. The competitive nature of the business will not allow that type of thing to happen. It is very competitive out there for customers, and they all have to keep their prices, you know, at the lowest they possibly can to maintain customers. And I believe that that is something that is not necessarily worried about. It ends up being a revenue neutral, of course, for the state, because it's not money that the state is taking in. It's strictly going into the industry for its own use. And we believe long-term that it actually saves money.
Thank you, Chair Rhodes. Council, Mr. Shepherd, do we have other organizations over the years, as you recall, that have done this consumer-driven?
Mr. Chair, members, the closest model I can think of is a number of commodity promotion councils that are authorized in statute, and it's roughly analogous in the statute authorizes the producers of the commodity to impose a fee to promote the product.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Shepherd, have those reports been given to the legislature, as you recall?
Mr. Chair and members, I will look that up. I don't know offhand if the Commodity Promotion Councils have reports to the legislature.
Mr. Chairman, I can probably answer the question, no, because I tried to get him to report to the council, at least have submit some report of expenditures to at least somebody, and Representative Rice was the chair of the committee and fought me completely on that.
Mr. Chair?
Representative.
But Representative Solberg, those were created under your leadership, correct?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think they were created far before I was around.
Oh.
Okay. I'll renew my motion. House Bill 2653, we recommend it to pass the Rules Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
I believe it does prevail.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, next bill up is Representative Osterman. Is that right? State Board of Investment.
You were right.
I think I know report. There's no report.
This goes to the Okay. I'll move House File 3061 be recommended to pass, and it goes to State Government Finance. Correct, Representative Osterman? That's what you want?
I believe that is correct, Mr.
Okay.
Chair. Thank you.
You want to go ahead and explain briefly what your bill does?
Absolutely. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. With me on my left this afternoon is Ray Frost. He's the director of MinBio, and he is going to spend a couple MinBio, M-N-B-I-O. It's a professional trade organization in the bioscience industry. The bill that we're going to talk to you about really deals with the philosophy of how we invest our money for the state of Minnesota. Ray serves on the Minnesota Bioscience Council, so I've asked him to kind of kick this off for us today.
Hi, welcome to our committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and explain.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ray Frost, Executive Director of the Minnesota Biotechnology Association, also known as MinBio. What you have before you is a proposal, a bill that talks about investing, as Representative Osterman said, in the bioscience industry. This industry, unlike many other industry, is very dependent upon venture capital financing from a variety of sources. This bill before you talks about investment from the venture capital area. It is a public-private partnership with the state of Minnesota. You will hear from some venture capitalists who have been in the industry for some time to talk to you more specifically about some stuff, but as Representative Osterman said, this bill has been talked about, this proposal has been talked about at the Bioscience Council, which was created by the governor last summer. We spent a great deal of time talking about this. This is a council which has representatives from industry and the public or private sector and the public sector. This is also modeled after what other states have done, other states like Pennsylvania, other states like Wisconsin to try and support the biotech, bioscience industry in their respective states. I'm happy to try and answer any questions you may have as to why we need this or why the proposal is before you today. But again, you will hear from some experts that can tell you much more about why this industry is so dependent upon venture capital and why the proposal is before you today. Thank you.
Right. With that, if I could bring up additional testimony.
Sure.
Okay.
How many people you got?
Mr. Harlan Jacobs and Mark Jensen are going to talk about this, for starters. We have 19 witnesses. I hope that's not a problem.
As long as they all take no time, we're
okay,
fine.
Okay, good.
Okay. In the interest of time, please start. Keep in mind there's 17 others following you.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for taking the time to let a few of us from the industry address this important subject. I'm here as a practitioner from the private sector who regularly helps companies organize venture capital investments, seed capital investments, and these companies that receive the funding from early stage venture capital investors are going to create some of the new important jobs for Minnesota in the next several decades. Obviously, with the few minutes that we have, and we'll limit ourselves to, I'm told, 4 minutes.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but the page author here was bothering me for a second. Did you identify yourself to the tape?
My name is Harlan Jacobs. Okay. I live in Minneapolis. I work in Columbia Heights.
That's fine. Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt you.
And I'm involved. We have an incubator program, a seed capital program, and we help entrepreneurs to get early stage capital, and I can tell you, from my personal experience over the last 10 years, that it's become increasingly difficult for early-stage companies, whether they're in biotech or the general fields of high technology, such as my colleague Mark Jensen will describe to you, to raise capital. And we're ladies and gentlemen of the committee, we are facing a peril which, for lack of a better phrase, I call bicoastalism. The venture capital pools are concentrated on the East and West Coast, and they tend to want to be near their investee companies. We've already lost one company in St. Paul that could have been a significant employer called Fireview. And what I don't want to have happen is for Mark Jensen to have to move his company to California. At this time, I'd like to ask Mark to tell you his background, what he's doing in Elk River, Minnesota. It's a very exciting company. It's called Simbet. It's a battery technology. It's going to employ hundreds of people at very high wages. He got started in Elk River because he's from Princeton. He now lives in Zimmerman. There's an incubator program in Elk River. There's a public sector, private sector collaboration called the Anoka-Sherburne County Capital Fund. It's an amalgam of banks, utility companies, and private investors. And these people have risked private sector money to help launch Minnesota companies. This is a story that you need to hear, and this is a company we dare not lose to the West Coast. And this is my colleague, Mark Jensen.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Jensen, founder of Simbet Corporation. I guess I'm here kind of as a poster boy for the starving entrepreneur that needs this sort of bill passed so that we can get the sort of funding we need to bring high-tech jobs, high-paying jobs into the Minnesota markets. I can verify that in raising the venture capital we have that we're often speaking to East and West Coast venture capitalists whose first term is, well, you're going to have to locate in Silicon Valley or Boston, something like that. We've been reluctant, obviously, to do that and have been fortunate enough to raise offshore funding to offset what we were not able to get here in Minnesota or elsewhere. So, you know, I would greatly support an effort like this to see more Minnesota money go to Minnesota startups that produce jobs for Minnesota, and it becomes a circle of more taxes coming into Minnesota.
Yeah.
And in addition, for example, in this startup, it's a high-tech a battery. It's a very small battery, solid-state battery that will go into microchips, very similar to a semiconductor-type process. We use all very high-skilled labor force. We have right now 22 people. Probably the average salary is around $70,000, and we see that really continuing. We're not going to see a great drop in the average because of the high-tech labor that's required to get this done. So we bring in not only high-quality jobs, but the taxes that the state is able to see off of that is also substantial.
Thank you very much. Anybody else want to come testify for or against the bill? Any questions for the committee members?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have B. Rothweiler at this point. Is Helen coming? No? Okay.
Yeah, how many more do you really have, seriously?
I think only about 11. No, we have only one more after that.
Okay. You say 11, so one sounds good. Okay. Hi, welcome to our committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
My name is Beatrice Rothweiler. I'm with a company called Portage Capital, and thank you for the opportunity to speak before you this afternoon. My partner and I, Brad Lehrman, have had a venture capital firm for the last 10 years and have been feet on the street in the early stage entrepreneurs in this community, along with Harlan, who you just heard from. And we have had the opportunity to not only be, we actually are attorneys by profession and have evolved into the advisors and investors and board members of these companies. We have had the pleasure of being able to invest two small funds in various companies. We've had 21 companies we've invested in. We've had one IPO as well as three acquisitions. Our current fund is about 54% in the bioscience area. We consider it a very strong part of our economy, and we want to continue to reflect that. We see venture capital as really part of an ecology that involves not only the ideas that our scientists, the universities, and founders have, but also coming together of the human capital that we need to grow these companies into successful participants in our economy. And that includes we need management, product development, and sales marketing. I have an outline here. It's too lengthy to go into at this point, but you can look at it at your leisure later. I'm just trying to highlight some of the.
I wish we had leisure time later, but I don't.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, your nighttime reading when you can't go to sleep otherwise. If you get to sleep.
Or we wake up in the middle of the night.
But investment capital is really the third leg of the stool. And I want to reiterate that I think that we have a lot of jewels in our and assets in our community that we can leverage if we have the proper amount of investment capital available to us. And traditionally, the way these companies grow is they start with family founders and friends. We call them the MCI group because they're really the people closest to these companies. Then they have to evolve beyond that, and usually they go to other angel investors and small VCs such as ourselves. And then when they come to a certain point, they will usually grow then to a larger VC. And as Harlan just mentioned just a few minutes ago, a lot of the larger VCs are not in this community. They are, in fact, on the coast. I have in my materials an outline of how early-stage companies grow through the various levels of VCs to the liquidity event, which is ultimately what all investors are interested in. But I thought it would be interesting for you to know about our portfolio a little bit. And one of the what we feel are the contributions to our economy here, right here in Minnesota. We've commercialized several of the latest technologies, including from various universities, not just here in Minnesota, but also from Johns Hopkins, from Spain, from the University of Pittsburgh. And we've created jobs. In our portfolio, we feel in the 21 companies we've been involved, obviously there are going to be some failures, but we've had a large degree of success and have created over 400 new jobs. And it involves high-wage kind of professionals that are not going to be sent offshore, and I know everybody's very concerned about that kind of that's a concern today for people, because our ideas as well as the development of these companies employ physicians and engineers of all kinds and physicists. Also, we're diversifying the economy. We've got, in our portfolio alone, we've got high-tech and nanotech. We've got software. We've got several medical device publishing, biotech, and medical services. I want to also emphasize what I think is also a historical change that's happened in this industry. We all look to the Medtronics of St. Jude's in our community, and we say, why can't we create more of those? There was a different model back then that allowed these companies to be really created on with the use of a lot more angel investments. There was faster periods to get to revenue with these companies back in those days. The FDA was not as strict and as stringent as it is today. It didn't take as long. We have we had a lot more vibrancy in the regional investment banking community that could amass angel investors to support these companies. Most of these regional investors, investment bankers, now have either merged with larger companies or gone away. So the strategy and the paradigm has shifted, and a lot of the money, as was mentioned earlier, has been controlled on the coast. So to keep this, to make sure that our economy continues to be vibrant and we have the next generation of companies, it's very important that we have access to this capital. just to highlight, too, we've got in our own portfolio, we've got several angel investors who have invested in the early stage of these companies, and we've also been able to attract regionally other VCs outside of our community. And that really is what I think is will be the model that we can look to. If the coasts are not going to participate in some of our companies, we can amass the strength right here in the upper Midwest as well as the other central states. I don't want to appear that the glass is half empty, because it really is half full. We do have wonderful assets here to leverage in our community. We have the ideas, the centers of excellence. We have the management talent. We've got the large Fortune 500 companies where a lot of these people will get their experience. But I do want to emphasize that capital is an integral part of making these companies grow and to contributing back to the economy. In our one company that we have that was an IPO, I can actually point to that company. Those investors now who have actually made their liquidity are now reinvesting back into new companies in our community, and that's the cycle. The ecology that we need to keep vibrant here.
Okay. Thank you very much. Did you really have somebody else coming?
Mr. Chair and members, there is an amendment to this bill.
Okay.
And Howard Bicker is here with the State Board of Finance to talk about that and talk about
the A1 amendment.
Correct.
I'll move the A1 amendment to get it in front of us. Everybody has a copy of the A1 amendment? There's a change, though, that you want that looks like Mr. Shepherd-Hand wrote.
There's a handwritten change, and I need a copy of that, too.
And it has that noted on there. You want to explain the amendment, or is this to put the bill in order? Is this a substantial change, or what's the story?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a couple technical things. On page 4, this really deals with the fact that on line 23 there, where the handwritten one, for instance, it really deals with the fact that there might be gains in the returns on investments, rather, might well exceed the $2 million mark. And so rather than say up to a limit of, we want to delete that. And then there are other small technical changes. But again, I think Mr. Bicker could talk about this as well.
Are you going to talk about the amendment then? Is that right? Otherwise, we can put the amendment on the amendment to put the bill in order that the author would like. Any questions? If not, on the A1 amendment as you have drafted here, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye opposed. All right, the amendment's on. Now, go ahead and talk to us.
The reason that I've asked Mr. Bicker to be here, and I bet you're all waiting, wondering, is not necessarily as much to speak to the amendment as to assist with, correct, I understand that, to assist with any technical questions that you might have about the legislation.
Representative Seifert has a technical question.
Well, Mr. Chair, I thank you, Mr. Bicker, for being here. I guess it is on page 4. State Board of Investment bills are not before this committee a lot, but I know that the main goal of the State Board of Investment when investing monies on behalf of pension funds, the state, whatever, is to maximize the rate of return for the investor, in other words, the state or the pension funds. And what we're saying here is that we would like the State Board to invest up to $200 million into these specific businesses, basically. Now, when I read lines 21 through 29, what we're basically saying is if the investments in these businesses are not at the level of return that is optimal or at a good level, that the general fund will make up the difference. Am I reading it wrong, or
that's interesting.
Or is that
Mr. Chairman and Representative, that's correct.
Okay, Mr.
Okay. Well, first of all, You have to identify yourself.
My name is Howard Becker. I'm the executive director of the State Board of Investment.
Okay. Representative Sykes.
Mr. Chair, I feel bad because I always end up being the bad guy who asks questions on bills, and it makes me feel stupid. We have a Republican author, and I know we're not supposed to question bills and so forth, but I guess I
you want to yield to me.
I do have a we've gotten into this in years past where if you like ethanol or biodiesel, let's take money out of the State Board of Investment and force them to put it in there. If we like Minnesota grown businesses, let's make them do that. And generally, in the past, we've kind of said let's let the State Board of Investment maximize where they feel. Even if it's the evil tobacco companies, Representative Kahn, if that's where the money is and that's where the good rate of return is, that's where the money should go because that's wise investing on behalf of our pensioners and so forth. And, my question, I love bioscience. That's the new buzzword. Everybody loves it's kind of like obesity. That's the big issue now. Bioscience, everybody loves it, and that's the new thing. But I guess I'm concerned that if these companies don't do well, and maybe Representative Osterman could answer the question for me. If these companies fall on their face, kind of like the tech bust that we had in 99-2000 where everybody was dot-com this and dot-com that, and all of a sudden when 2001 came along, it was, well, we overinvested in dot-com and technology, and the bubble burst and the stock market went down, and those investments basically got wiped out in a lot of cases. Now, the new buzzword like dot-com was in 97, 98, 99 is bioscience. And we may come running into this in an aggressive fashion and then decide, well, I mean, we don't have control over the stock market very much. I'm just raising the concern that this is a pretty big decision that we're making here, that, this isn't just whether you're for biosciences or not. This is a pretty major thing that we're doing. And I don't know if these things go belly up like the dot-com industry did in the late 90s, and we come back in a biennium or two, are we going to have money in the general fund when Representative Boudreaux is trying to find money for Health and Human Services and Representative Segrin is trying to find money for K-12, and then we're saying, well, we made this decision to throw $200 million into biosciences, and we're short $50 million, and we have to come up with that. That's my statement slash question is how does this work here if things go poorly like that? And I'm using that analogy because it's a real one from the late 90s.
So the question is it made up in the general fund?
Yes.
I asked them to yield it.
Yeah.
And yours?
Line 26, 27 on page 4, Mr. Chair. That's my concern about it. I think this is a worthy investment. I think bioscience is exciting. I've gone to some of the conferences they've had, but This is pretty important because, quite honestly, a lot of our pension funds are going broke right now. For those of you who sit on Ways and Means.
Representative Haas, Solberg, and Knobloch. Representative Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I didn't catch the gentleman's name from the Board of Investment, but I do have a question for him because I know in the investment community, whenever you're dealing with a pool of funds, you always have an investment discipline that you follow, and you do not invest too heavily in one sector, and you have limits of what you will put in a sector and then limits what you'll put in any one company. How does this scenario fit into the Board of Investment's investment discipline that they have set up?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, first of all, the State Board of Investment, this is not their bill. Okay. The Board has no position on this bill. What we have done is work to make it technically work and so on and so forth. What is being suggested here is that the board make up to $200 million in investments in, excuse me, I got a good cold, more geographically focused, more industry focused, and probably generally smaller investments than we have historically done. We've made investments in Minnesota Venture Capital, and we've been doing that for over 20 years. When we were approached by this, and again, this is from a staff perspective, so I don't mean to be, I'm not speaking for the board because the board has not taken a position on this. Our response was, if you want us to take slightly higher risk, and it could be even a lot higher risk than we normally take, we want to have some downside guarantees. Mm-hmm. So if we're going to fill a perceived capital gap, for that, we were willing to, one, go from 20% exposure, which is what we normally do in a deal, up to 50, because these are going to be small deals. Second of all, we want a minimum rate of return. Our original proposal was a minimum of 8.5%, which is our actuarial assumed rate. The authors have added the additional provision that basically says if our normal venture capital investment outside of this program doesn't return 8, then that will be the new bogey. I mean, our, from a staff perspective, we prefer just to have 8.5 as a solid number out there, because we're already getting comments from various retiree groups as to, mm-hmm. you know, what are you doing with these dollars. So our preference would be just to have a straight 8.5% bogey. At that stage, what we could really say, at least to retirees, is that we are meeting the minimum rate of return for the pension plan to maintain a full funded status, and that's 8.5%. Now, you are correct in the sense that if, and this is over a long period of time, venture capital investments, and we invest in pools, we don't do an individual deal. As the gentleman was up here before talking about his battery operation, we wouldn't invest in that. What we would do is invest in limited partnerships, have general partners make those individual investment decisions. So we're one removed. All we do is invest in general limited partnerships, and they go ahead. If, and these partnerships take anywhere from 10 to 15 years to really go full cycle from the investment period and so on and so forth. The way the bill is currently constructed, it's 2019. What we would do is look at the investments made under this authority if this was to be passed, and that would be up to $200 million of those. Compare the return of those investments over the period of time to 2019. And then look at, are those returns higher than 8.5? If they are, everybody's fine. If they're lower than 8.5, then the state would have an obligation to provide the decremental return that the fund received because of these investments. Now, right now, also, the provision would say we'd have to look at our return of other venture capital and compare that. Again, our recommendation would be just to have the 8.5% as the hurdle rate. It makes it much more explainable to these various retiree groups that are already questioning some of the moves.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Yes, there's a pass.
To the testifier, does this does the $200 million in this particular sector exceed your investment discipline that you have set up as a guideline?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we have about $3 billion in what we call alternative investments and about another $1.5 billion to go. So I mean, we have plenty of allocation to do this. What it does that is different than what we currently do is to geographically focus and to focus on certain types of investments within that geography. And because the way this is going to work, it's going to be in relatively small funds. Right now, most of the funds that we invest in will invest $100-$200 million in a limited partnership just because of the due diligence and time and staff it takes. These we would probably be making $10-$20 million investments in a number of small partnerships. So it's a different program than what we're doing. It has a higher degree of risk, and that's why we're also asking for the guarantee piece of this equation to justify the additional level of risk.
Mr. Chair, what has been your historical risk factor on ventures like this? Is it extremely high, or is it moderate, or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we look at our alternative investment program kind of more in aggregate, and that includes oil and gas, big private equity, leveraged buyouts, and venture. Our returns on this plan over the last 15 years have been in, you know, the mid teens, 15, 16, 17% net to us. That's including all fees and carried interest. So it's been a very successful program. It's served the state Board of Investment and the retirees well. So we think, you know, this kind of investment in general is a very good idea, and most of the major pension plans have a program. So, you know, they all vary, but they have a program. This would be, you know, slightly different in the sense small, geographically focused, and industry focused, and that because of that additional level of risk, we said that we need, at least we believe from a prudent standpoint, if we are to fill a capital gap, so to speak, if we're going to fill that capital gap, we want some guarantees on the other side.
And Mr. Chair, one last comment. Members, I think we really need to take a long, hard look at this because we have a fiduciary responsibility. The board has one, and we also as legislators have a fiduciary responsibility to make sure these pension plans stay whole and do what, you know, we promised the retirees they would do with them and provide them income and not jeopardize that. And I think we really have to proceed cautiously on this issue because if we make a mistake on this, and you know, and I sense a kind of a concern by the Board of Investment that the only way they move forward on this is to have the taxpayers back any loss in this if they don't get the 8.5%, and you know that gives them level of comfortability. But what happens if we're in an economic time like we are today, and we can't put in the money to shore this up? What is it going to do? And are we going to then, as a legislature, start accruing future pension liability that we're going to have to make up? And I think there's too many questions unanswered on this to really make a good decision on this today. I think we need a lot more information and a lot more level of comfortability as we move forward.
Representative Silver.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert, you don't have to go to the .com to show a bubble burst. I'll give you some biotech companies that I invested in that are kind of bursted too in that when the bubble burst. And again, I think I agree wholeheartedly with the Representative Haas, and that there's another big concern I have on that, and that is there doesn't seem to be any review of the performance of this until 2019, and then if it doesn't hit that 8.5%, it's an obligation right then, as opposed to an ongoing obligation. And then, you know, what kind of net present value does that give us today or back then in 2019 as well? So I agree wholeheartedly that we all want venture capital. Maybe this is a good spot for me to have $49 million replaced in the 21st Century Mineral Fund. That's good venture capital. It actually produces some jobs. But I think this is very risky.
Representative Nabok.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Chair, first of all, I have some questions for Mr. Jacobs or some of the previous witnesses when we're done here. But Mr. Bicker, as long as you're up there, let me ask you a couple questions. First, as I understand this, the main change in the law I'm seeing is that right now you do not invest directly in startup companies or venture capital investments directly in companies right now. I understand you only invest in pools of some kind. And as I understand, you would not put in more than 20%. You would not take up more than 20% of an offering, let's say, in a venture capital pool. So if there is a pool that's raising $50 million to do venture capital investments, you wouldn't take more than $10 million of it right now underneath your current statutes. And I see what I think you're doing here, what the legislation proposed to say, is that for this bill, you could take up to 50% of a pool if it was at least 50% invested in Minnesota companies and it met the other criteria in terms of bioscience. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abloy, that's correct.
Okay. And do you, Mr. Bicker, do we typically do 20% of a pool, or how often do we go up to the current 20% limit right now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, it's not unusual for us to be very close to that.
Okay. And Mr. Bicker, Mr. Chairman, are there vehicles right now in Minnesota, are there pools available that have at least 50% of their funds going into Minnesota businesses?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, there are a number of venture capital organizations in Minnesota, and we've invested in a fair number of those, but there is no predetermined percentage. As been explained by some of the previous speakers, you tend to do a fair amount where you are geographically located. It's just easier. Also, in the investment, in the venture capital business, there's a lot of what's known as trading. I may be in Minnesota and you may be in Silicon Valley. I see a deal here. I can't take it all. I will have you invest a part of mine. You'll have one in Silicon Valley. You need some money. I will invest in you. So there's trading. There are very few venture capital operations that really geographically limit themselves.
Okay. So, Mr. Bicker, Mr. Chairman, I guess this bill anticipates that if it would pass, there would be some pools created that would promise to at least invest 50% of their money in Minnesota, since apparently none exist that do that now. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, it would be my anticipation that a fair amount of the organizations that would participate, if this would go along, may be existing organizations that currently have funds that do not have any geographical limitations that may start a new fund to fit within these parameters. So we may not necessarily have new organizations. It would be organizations that would probably form new limited partnerships to meet those criteria.
I think we have a difference of opinion.
Well, Mr. Chair, Ray Frosty, and I would never differ with Mr. Bicker. He's smarter than I. But what I'd like to just make clear is that there are other states that do this. This is not unique. As a matter of fact, we're slow to come to the race. Wisconsin does this, our neighbors, and they do pool it for the upper Midwest, which is very similar to what we have here.
Do they take the money out of their general fund if they're short?
That is the only thing, Mr. Chair, that is absolutely different, and Wisconsin's been doing it, I think, since 1999, and then I believe reauthorized the program again to add more money from the State Board of Investment to go towards this. And just a couple of other things I want everybody to know so everybody's clear. Just as information, this bill's been heard in the Senate twice in two committees, and no one's one testified against it, no one's voted against it.
We never compare ourselves to the Senate, however.
No.
Thank goodness.
But number two, this was something that gubernatorial candidate Pawlenty was very, very strongly in favor of. And then rightfully so, when he became governor, said he had a fiduciary responsibility as chair of the board, and then said he hoped someone else would pick up the ball. So one, this is not something that Minnesota is saying to do, and we're a little late to the race on this. And the other thing that I think is key here, this bill simply authorizes the State Board of Investment to enter into these limited partnerships. Doesn't mandate it. If the State Board of Investment, and Mr. Bicker can talk more about this, never sees something that is worthwhile to them to invest in, they simply say no. If the limited partnerships come to the State Board of Investment with ideas, and those ideas, for the most part, are not good and worthwhile investments, they have the absolute authority to say no to those. This does not mandate them to invest.
Mr. Chairman, I guess my last question for Mr. Bicker then. Mr. Bicker, here we're saying that up to 65% of the amount could be invested in bioscience investments. If you looked at the whole venture capital world and all the different investments that are out there that are available in venture capital, what percentage would you roughly estimate are bioscience-type investments?
Mr. Chairman, I represent Knobloch. I really couldn't give you a number, but it's not 65. But this said we could go up to 65. It could be 5. It could be 10. It could be 50.
10, 15% maybe?
25.
25%. Okay. And then either Mr. Bicker or Ms. Osterman, I think I heard the number that if, just in terms of our total maximum general fund exposure here, if we put the $200 million in, if we assume the 8.5% return, 15 years went by, let's say none of it panned out, which I realize is unlikely. Certainly you would think some things would pan out, but if nothing panned out, I think I heard $679 million as the general fund liability that would be made up. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, I believe that's very close.
You don't look at it.
But that's also assuming, you know, $200 million is spent day one and, you know, various and everything.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
But yes, the value on that is still $200 million.
Yes.
Okay. Representative Haas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, members, as I said, I think this is such an issue that has some long-reaching effects to our pensioners and to the taxpayers of the state that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to lay this bill on the table because we need a lot more work layover on it.
Bill has been recommended layover. Representative Osterman?
Mr. Chair and members, I know it's probably not my place. I don't know why you don't want to vote on this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, before this happens, I guess I'd like to ask, I forgot the gentleman's name up there with you. I assume he's from one of the venture capital firms.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knobloch, I'm the industry representative. We have the venture capital people sitting over there.
Well, I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, could I have Harlan Jacobs or one of the people come back? I'd like to ask him a question or two if we've got time.
Mr. Jacobs?
Well,
was
the motion
on the table? On
your
way up,
wait, wait, wait,
motion.
You're right.
Also,
Proceduralized. Go ahead.
Well, let me just
motion
say that
is
this
not
is also
debatable to lay it over. Actually, did you say lay on the table or lay it over? There's a difference.
I put it laid on the table.
Laid on the table. Not that's debatable. Not debatable. That's a motion that we just have to vote up or down.
I'll hold that motion until okay. Representative Knobloch has a chance to
he can get his question
address the.
All right. Well, thank
his question.
Thank you very much, Representative Haas, Mr. Jacobs or Mr. Rothweiler. I guess I'm curious. I mean, we've heard about all this lack of venture capital money in Minnesota, and I guess I'm just curious. I remember thinking it was 6 or 7 years ago on the front of Fortune magazine, there was the title Moneyapolis, and it talked about all the venture capital money that was here in the Twin Cities. And I know some of the people that were highlighted in that article are, shall we say, no longer active in the investing business. But let me ask, you know, I mean, what's your view in terms of what happened? I mean, I guess one of the things I hear is that we're one of very few states that for state income tax purposes do not have a disregard of 50% or 60% of our capital gains income like the federal government does and like almost every other state does. I mean, is that a part of the reason that you think that we have a lack of venture capital here, or what, you know, what reasons do you feel that what's changed in the last 6, 7 years ago since we were Moneyapolis?
At the risk of not letting the lady speak first, I do have a quick answer, and then I would certainly defer to my colleague, Beatrice. One of the problems that I would say is, I'll call it the Naples factor. Too many of our Minnesotans are going to Naples, Florida, and other places like that to avoid Minnesota taxes, and they are taking every piece of advice their CPAs and tax advisors give them to not have any nexus of connection to taxability in Minnesota, including failing to make investments. There's money that could be mobilized from people that know Minnesotans, have made money here, they're ready to invest, but they won't. So that's a structural problem. The other problem is venture capitalists, like everybody else, get older. And as they get older, they tend to take less risks. And over the last 30, I came here from Des Moines, Iowa. I came here because this was a hotbed of venture capital and technology development. And I would be very sad if we become just a large-scale corporate version of Des Moines. Des Moines has no venture capital, and Des Moines does not have the kind of companies like Medtronic and Simbet and others that will grow the kind of jobs that you and I and our neighbors and constituents want to have. And those pools of capital, those investment bankers, and those others that were helping to get this job done, especially the business angels who have fled the state, collectively, that's a significant decrement in the available amount of resources, and that's why we find ourselves in the position we do. Contemporaneous with that, you have other states where they're acting boldly and recklessly, taking money from their tobacco settlements, taking money from other pools of capital, and risking it, pardon the phrase, naked in this area. So when Wisconsin takes $120 million out of its state pension fund without the benefit of the safety net, and they just make investments, they're making themselves very attractive to Minnesota companies. And California and other locations have an abundance of venture capital, and they tend to aggregate in those areas. So I defer to my colleague.
I'm sorry, I don't believe I read the article you're speaking about, so I'm not exactly sure what they were talking about in that article. I do remember, however, five, six years ago, I would say venture capital was giving, got a lot more press, and I think what was happening, we have some VCs in this community, and they were probably getting more press at that time, but it, the nature of the dollars that generally are controlled in VCs are on the coast, and they still were on the coast during that time period. But what's happened was the velocity of money was at that point going so quickly that they were starting to realize and competing with each other out in their own backyards, which is traditionally where they would invest, that at that point I think there was more venture capitalists who were willing to come here and to look at investments in companies here. That whole thing, that whole cycle changed after 2000, and they've all basically withdrawn and stayed close to the vest and tried to rehabilitate the investments that they've had. That's I think one of the major shifts that's happened over the last 6 or 7 years. And if you look at the statistics that are published quarterly, they're usually in the Star Tribune, you can see that our dollars nationally, percentage-wise, the VC investments is declining here locally. And I think that's a reflection of what's happened, not so much necessarily here, but really what's happened on the coast with the VCs and their investments. And I think Harlan is talking, Harlan's points are very well taken too, and I think what he's addressing is maybe more the angel community too, which I think is another pool of investment dollars. The typical venture capitalists, the larger ones especially, are not in this community. So we have to attract them here. And the way we as a small fund have done that is to create syndicates, as Howard Bickert had also spoke to, and try to attract some of these people to come closer. And we find that it's easier geographically to go to, there's some venture funds that are based in Iowa, some in Chicago, Kansas City, and so we try to syndicate within the upper Midwest area. And then as they continue to get larger and you get to a certain stage where you probably validated your product, they're out in the market and want to expand nationally, then you tend to go to the coast where the bigger dollars are sitting in their pools and can be committed to those companies. And we're beginning to see some thawing out of that now we are attracting more of the coastal VCs here.
Follow-up, Representative Knobloch.
No, Mr. Chair. I just appreciate the chance to ask about that issue and hear that the tax climate is a big factor, and you know there are other cyclical factors and other factors apparently at work. Thank you again, Mr. Chair, for your willingness to lay aside your motion temporarily.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to point out a couple of other things which I don't understand in this. First of all, if we look on page 3, lines 4 through 15, looks as if there's an awful lot of, or starting from maybe back on, looks like there's an awful lot of this that's private data that is different, I think, from other investments that the state has. And I don't know, maybe Mr. Bickert could explain that.
Mr. Bickert?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, what you're talking about is obviously there's a data practices law. We currently, before this bill, are having already difficulty being able to invest our pension assets in venture capital. And that is because venture capitalists will not have public money because we have to disclose a lot of data that they are finding very problematic in their investment. And it's a serious problem for us. There's been court cases. University of California was investing in a big firm called Sequoia. They didn't want certain data out because they felt it would be a competitive disadvantage in what they're doing. courts ruled that they had to disclose the data. Sequoia asked them to withdraw. They did not, but Sequoia told them, don't bother coming back to the next round. A lot of the very good venture capital, private equity firms are becoming less willing to deal with public entities because of what we have to disclose. We're more than willing to disclose. We made an investment with a firm, how much money we put in, and what the returns are. But in part of our due diligence, we got to look at, you know, underlying portfolio companies and whatnot, see how it's going, make up our mind whether we're going to go into the next fund or not. That data is very, very problematic for the private equity, venture capital organizations. And what's unfortunate is the only data requests we get are from organizations that are using it to sell it to somebody else. So we're getting data requests for people to make money on our data at the detriment of our pensioners. And it's a real serious problem.
Follow-up, Representative Kahn.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm also looking at the investment vehicle. Is I don't think there's something about having the headquarters in Minnesota. I think an awful lot of this investment could then be done. You'd have a company that could set up a token headquarters in Minnesota, and the jobs and the activity could really be done anyplace else in the country or in the world.
Well,
Mr. Bickert.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, if people want to start playing shell games, I assume some of that could happen. You attempt to control that as much as you can. If this one went along and this became law, we would make criteria when we invested in a general partner that they make sure that they attempt to ensure they comply with the law.
But that's not
follow
required,
up, Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, that's not required by the law, though.
It would, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I didn't write this, but at least my interpretation is there should be every attempt to have these headquarters and the jobs be here also.
Well,
follow-up, Representative Kahn.
I did see the headquarters was listed, but it doesn't really mean that all of the business has to be done in the state. And I clearly see, problems that I have with this. I have problems with the privacy issues. I have problems with there's no guarantee that this investment will benefit Minnesota. I have great problems with that, particularly after the last bill. You notice we don't do any analysis until 2019. That's when which is already pointed out, we could be losing an awful lot by 2015. Then the other thing is we have this a sunset of August 1st, 2019, and judging by the last bill, I would assume that we'd have a bill in here in 3 more years to get rid of that 2019 sunset on the ground that it was interfering with the business that they were trying to do.
It's job security for us, Representative Kahn. Something for us to do, right?
Well, the job security for us is you want to keep the sunsets so we get to look at them each year instead of get rid of them. And then the final point I'd like to point out is I've been talking to a lot of scientists recently and talking about bioscience investments and so forth, and they said they thought that of high detriment to bioscience development in the state of Minnesota would be a state that was going to pass an anti-evolutionary statement in their education standards. And I do notice that 3 out of the 4 authors of this bill, or majority of the authors of this bill, all voted for the creationist amendment. So I would suggest that you figure out among yourselves how you're going to put your priorities in place.
Representative Erickson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say, Representative Kahn, that's an inaccurate statement you just made. So, you can't say that about the science standards and creationism. You need to read those amendments again. But anyway, Mr. Chair, I want to know from Mr. Bicker, I want to know if Deed is here, because this is from... we have this letter in front of us from Mr. Kramer to the governor, and I'm just wondering if someone is here who can talk about this risk that we might be taking in regard to the state and our finances and what it might do to the State Board of Investments' reputation.
That was a question I never
So if you would comment on this, sir.
State your name. Welcome to the committee. If you state your name and who you represent for the record, you may proceed.
Gene Goddard. I am the bioscience industry specialist for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I serve as the lead staff to the Bioscience Council and lead staff for the Governor's Bioscience Initiative. Mr. Chair, Representative, could you please restate your question?
Well, I want to know to what extent DEED is underwriting this and why we would take the risk of using the State Board of Investment. Is there any other avenue to pursue for venture capital? Did you look at others?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, this is not being underwritten by DEED in any way. The recommendation came from the Bioscience Council over 6 months' worth of deliberations through the council itself and through the Finance Committee, which was made up of six members from the council itself and members of the investment community and bioscience industry that wanted to participate in those meetings. We looked at a number of options at this point for venture capital programs to try to boost the number of venture capital activities in the state. We looked at what other states are doing. Mr. Frost mentioned our friends across the border in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and many other states that are currently doing this. There are, if I remember the exact numbers, over 20 states currently have a similar program where they take dollars out of their state board's investment and invest in venture capital firms for investments. We have a critical problem in this state with our venture capital industry and not making investments here. Those dollars have flown, as you have seen repeated numerous times in the Minneapolis papers. This industry is particularly requiring a large investment out of the venture dollars. We need to come up with some mechanism to do that, and this is what the board of the Minnesota Bioscience Council felt was the best option at this point for us, is to target investments from the State Board of Investment into venture firms that would then look at investments in the state or state of Minnesota or the upper Midwest.
Follow-up, Representative Erickson, just short, because we're pressing time now.
Mr. Gothard, how about in Pennsylvania? Was that as successful as Wisconsin?
It has been very successful. In fact, a company which is headquartered here, AppTech, which is a burgeoning bioscience company, moved their manufacturing facility to Pennsylvania because of investments from their State Board of Investment into venture firms and to take advantage of tax rezone opportunities that they have there. So right now, currently, they are building a $200 million plant similar to Protein Designs plant that is being built in Brooklyn Park because of Pennsylvania investment activity.
Thank you.
Representative Solberg? Fast. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, anyone up there, what happens if the rate of return is above 8.5? Where does that money go then?
Mr. Goddard?
If the rate of return is above 8.5%, that goes to the pensioners. And typically in the venture capital industry, returns are run anywhere from 20 to 35%. Beatrice Rothweiler, her first fund, the Portage Capital Fund 1, returned 41%. So if Mr. Bicker and his staff is choosing to make investments in those firms and those investments are above the 8.5%, they go to the pensioners. And if I remember right from his numbers out of his annual report, that their alternative investment fund has returned in the last year over 16.5%.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson? Okay. Members, at this time, there's no other questions. We'll lay the bill on the table. So thank you very much. Next bill is Representative Broads.
Don't we have to vote on that, Mr. Chair?
If you're laying it on the table.
Okay. Members, I'll withdraw that motion. We'll just lay the bill over.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's easier.
Thank you.
Okay.
Then we can take
it. Representative Broad, House File 2905. I'll move House File 2905 be recommended to pass. And
hi, Mark.
I think this may have to go to State Government Finance. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. I appreciate your time here today. House File 2905 brings before you a few things. It brings before you an opportunity for efficiency, an example of cooperation, and the ability to use the best bang for the taxpayers' dollars. All of this can be done within the purchasing standards set forth through cooperative purchasing by state agencies. by giving them further choice. And I do have a couple amendments, and I also have some witnesses here to testify in favor of the bill, Mr. Chair, whatever your preference is.
Do you want to do the amendment first?
Please.
Okay. Then I'll move the 1219 amendment. Representative Broad, explain to us what it'll do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Essentially, this amendment alters the bill, and we'll... I do have one further amendment, if we could.
Yes, I have that one. Is that an amendment to the amendment?
There is, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and that's the A2?
Correct.
Okay. Then I'll move the A2 amendment, and that incorporates and puts the 1219 amendment in order.
We don't have it.
Okay.
Coming around.
They're coming around. Members, if we put the amendment to the amendment on, then we can discuss the amendment as it is. So I think everybody has a copy. So all in favor of the A2 amendment to the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Now to the 1219 amendment. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Essentially, what this amendment does is that it requires the commissioner to provide another choice for state agencies in terms of how they do their cooperative purchasing. I do have with me today Mike Hike, he's the director of cooperative purchasing with the National Joint Powers Alliance, and also I have Gary Needus with the North Central Service Cooperatives to discuss any of the specifics of the bill.
All right. Who would like to be first? If you identify yourself for the record, then you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gary Needus, and I am the Executive Director of the North Central Service Cooperative, which is one of nine regional service agencies created by Minnesota Statute 123A.21. We are a political subdivision of the state. Although we have no taxing authority and we get no state aid, we are an entrepreneurial business created by you to help government agencies save money. And that's why we're here today. We just flew back from our Association of Educational Purchasing Agencies convention in Las Vegas to present here today, and that's a 21-state group that we have formed that's purchasing for about 32 million students right now across the nation. Mr. Hike, my associate representing the National Joint Powers Alliance, represents now 3,800-plus political subdivisions in 50 states and four foreign countries. And the efforts of the National Joint Powers Alliance are continuing to help governments not only in the rest of the country, but right here in the United States, right here in Minnesota. Excuse me, as we've discovered when we gave testimony in the Senate, the Senate chambers actually has purchased, re-carpeted, and the carpeting was purchased through the National Joint Powers Alliance. So, just to give you a little background as to where we're coming from, our little service cooperative is located in Staples, Minnesota. The North Central Service Co-op owns the National Joint Powers Alliance and is a co-founder of the American Association of Educational Purchase Agencies. This bill, if you should choose to pass it, would allow us to work more closely with the Department of Administration, the Procurement Section and Materials Management Division. The amendments that you have before you, of course, have been worked out and negotiated so that we believe we have no opposition to this bill.
Okay.
With that, I would introduce Mike Hike, our Director of Co-op Purchasing.
Mr. Hike, welcome to the committee. If you identify yourself for the record, you may proceed.
Yes, I am Mike Hike. I'm the Director of Cooperative Purchasing for the National Joint Powers Alliance. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I thank you for this opportunity to offer some opportunities to save and conserve valuable tax dollars through leveraging national volume. We'll not only leverage the national volume, but we also leverage national relationships, which are very important in developing national volume. We work very hard at establishing relationships in other states and as well as in Canada to bring their volumes together to establish better pricing, to bring it right back home here to Minnesota to serve even the smallest customers at the highest volume opportunities. So this bill, we feel, is a very good step in the right direction to a real cooperative partnership with the state contract people and make some real efficiencies available to all state agencies. We leverage our pricing based on volume that's established by all of the like customers all across the country. A good example of that is our copier contract, where the smallest customer can buy at the 375 machine price level, one machine at a time. So everything that's involved with doing that has been laid before you as an opportunity, and we thank you for your time.
Okay. Representative Solberg, is this to the amendment or?
Not to the amendment, okay, per se, so but to the testifier.
Okay, because I was going to say, if we put the amendment on,
you can
finalize the amendment here, and then we'll go into discussion on the bill. Okay, any further discussion on the 1219 amendment? Otherwise, I renew my motion. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion then prevails to the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg. The gentleman from the...
Mr. Nitas?
The cooperative.
Oh, Mr. Hike.
You said that it's a business, but if I recall right, I think my school district contributes to your existence as for the cooperatives. Is that correct?
Mr. Nitas or...
Mr. Chair, Representative, the North Central Service Cooperative operates differently than the other eight service cooperatives in the state. Our annual membership fees to our members are $10 a year.
But,
Representative Solberg,
Mr. Chairman, the other ones, you may be unique in it, but the other cooperatives are supported in part by an assessment to the school districts. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. Some of them have rather high membership fees, and they survive on those fees. We don't. We act like the Walmart in this arena, where there is no membership fee to get in the door. You look for good deals, and you purchase good deals. We're not the Sam's Club, where you have to, first of all, pay a high membership fee and then hope that you can find a good deal on the shelf.
Mr. Chairman, sir, how much of your income is related to the sale of insurance?
Mr. Nitas.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we keep all of our funds separate. We have 42 cost centers in our service co-op. Our insurance pool, our risk management pool, is about $16 million a year. We're the smallest of the eight service co-ops that operate in that arena. We get a $5 per contract per month from our customers in an administrative fee. About half of that money goes to actual administrative costs, and the rest of it goes back into the pool to support the self-insured program.
Follow-up, Representative.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, could you say then that all these places where you buy the volume from are located in Minnesota?
No.
Mr. Nitas.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, they're not.
Oh.
Follow-up, Representative Silver.
How many are located offshore?
Mr. Chair, Representative, none that I know of.
So, but how many are located, Mr. Chair, in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair and Representative, our goal at all times, and I'll put this out as give you some further information, is I also sit on the Staples Motley School Board, and I personally am very concerned, interested and sensitive to the local issues, and I deal with that on every decision that we make. Within my local school board's arena. So when we develop contracts, what we try to do is we leverage the volume and the commitment at the manufacturer's level, then bring them back to the local dealer to give them even a better tool to serve our customers. There's an isolated case or two where there's a mail order opportunity where that is possibly located outside of the state of Minnesota, but the majority of the contracts, the vast majority of the contracts that are in there come back directly and further serve local dealerships and distributors of the products that you're seeing before you there. And it, again, is always a goal of ours and mine personally to always make sure that the local economies are very very well represented.
Representative Solberg, follow-up?
No, Mr. Chairman, but several years ago, we tried our best to do away with cooperatives because it's another layer of government. And quite frankly, I taught for many years, and I know that the fees that were given to our school district paid into the cooperative, and I, as a classroom teacher, saw zero benefit from it.
Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Solberg, pursued by
line of questioning pretty well, but I would like to follow that up. First of all, I want to say I'm appreciative of the exemption for MnCorp in this bill, but I'm wondering, given the testimony that we just heard, whether it might not be appropriate to have something in this bill that would specify priority given to Minnesota businesses, since the intent of the bill seems to be in the opposite direction.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, and Representative Hilty, thank you for your question. And Representative Solberg, I appreciate your comments as well. I would say that the bill does set forth the requirements on the purchase cooperatives, the same requirements as are currently set in place for the Department of Administration in terms of their procurement. So if that's something we'd like to do in terms of procurement in general in the state of Minnesota, we certainly could move that direction, I suppose, if that's what the legislature determined to do. What this bill does is set forth the parameters that are similar, and to make them the same, they have to comply.
Follow-up, Representative Hilty.
Well, just a follow-up remark, Mr. Chair, as to the response to Representative Solberg's question about businesses located offshore. I think, sir, you should maybe check your list pretty carefully, because currently I believe there are more than 1,700, some of which have as many as 1,200 subsidiaries.
Any further discussion on the bill? Is there anyone here from the audience who wish to testify for or against this bill? Representative Erickson.
Well, Chair Haas and Representative Solberg, the EXU, as is I think you were alluding to, was created by this legislature and subsidized by this legislature. And I think when you were in the majority, we moved from an EXU to a different kind of an organization, correct? And then they designed a fee structure, some of them, all of them except this particular resources and solutions or that kind of organization. Is that correct?
Well, Representative
Mr.
Solberg?
Chairman, I don't remember exact history. I think you may be correct, the EXUs. I know that one time they had levy authority.
Right.
And I think we've taken the levy authority away from them. I wanted to do away with them, period, because I we had a good friend in the on our side of the aisle that liked them, so it was a fight. In fact, if I recall, the conference committee that we were serving on, Representative Kahn, we had a notwithstanding, and then the education committee put a notwithstanding the notwithstanding. So we came back with a notwithstanding, a notwithstanding, the notwithstanding. And had a battle going on of how many notwithstandings we could have on. But
and then who could stand it, right?
That's true. But, you know, again, I go back to no matter if it's a tax levy or a fee to the school district, I, as a classroom teacher, saw zero benefit from it.
All right. Further discussion? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 2905, as amended, be referred to the State Government Finance Committee. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No. Motion prevails. There is no further business. So at this time, whoops. Okay, we're going to meet Monday night after session to do the stadium.
Doesn't this have to go to rules first before it can go to finance? We're past the deadline. We're not supposed to be meeting.
That's right. Representative Solberg, I've been informed that the committee was instructed to move the bills through the committees and then to rules.
Yeah.
And then out. So we'll go to State Government Finance and then from there to rules.
Okay.
At that point.
All right.
And then we also need the minutes for March 17th to be approved. Representative Newman, you look like you read them very well. So we have a motion to approve the 3:17 minutes. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion then prevails. So Monday night after session, the stadium. Have a good afternoon. Meeting is adjourned.